And now, I'm happy to take questions. And if you want to know more, then have a look at our blog.
I'm going to somewhat argue the case for the banks, but it's not a case that I feel particularly strongly about, and I certainly don't work for a bank. The issue here is surely that any security system probably contains flaws and will eventually be compromised. To replace the whole of the card banking system within one country, worldwide or whatever, is a very great undertaking. So it does seem to me that the only choice the banks have is to predict the period during which the system will remain secure and have the new replacement system ready to field at the end of that period, whether or not they're aware of any compromise. Do you think they can do better than this?
I think there are a few ways they could do better. One way that would happen is, it is very true that the banks are not trying to build a 100% secure system, and they shouldn't, because that would be far too expensive. What they should be doing is trying to find a system that is a good compromise between the investment into the system and the losses of fraud that it would incur. Unfortunately, that's not quite working, because if the banks want to build a new system, they spend the money. But if there are flaws in the bank security system, it's the customers which are losing. So there's misaligned incentives between the customers and the banks. And I think that's one of the reasons that the banks aren't deploying all the security systems that they could. So in particular, the fraud detection systems are not as good in the UK as in many other countries. And those are fairly successful at reducing fraud, whereas the chip and PIN system costs probably £2 billion to roll out, and I don't think it's saved £2 billion worth of fraud losses. But it has managed to shift liability from the banks to the customer. So it hasn't necessarily been beneficial in an overall perspective, but it has been beneficial to the banking industry. What they could do better, one thing would be to listen to researchers. Because we said, for example, I think 3 years ago, that chip and PIN terminals had a flaw which allowed you to intercept the card details in the PIN. And the response was to say, essentially, criminals are too stupid to do that. And then 2 years later, criminals were doing it, and then the bank scrambled into fixing it. And it took them over a year to do anything about it. So they had a year worth of fraud, when instead, if they'd been able to predict that this would have happened, they could have very leisurely rolled out a fix, and then the criminals would have been prevented from doing this fairly obvious thing when they actually were able to do it. So I think being better at predicting the future would be very useful, and I think they could do that.
Okay, so they effectively had the time to do the right thing, and they chose not to do it because they either didn't want to or because they didn't believe the analysis.
Yeah, certainly in that case, and there are probably other examples.
Are you aware of any legal cases that have been... I think, obviously, if it's obviously in this particular country quite expensive to risk taking the banks to task over this for an individual that may have lost out or possibly lost out. Are you aware of any situation that is been approached that obviously the banks do not want this to go to court? Are you aware of any situation where they've paid out of court before any proceedings? Or has it just not got there at all?
The banks are quite reluctant for things to go to court, but if they do make it, then they're very aggressive at prosecuting it. So, for example, I was an expert witness in a court case where a Halifax customer sued his bank over some disputed transactions. And this person was a refugee, so he had no money and no ability to earn money. So although he was putting himself at risk at a very large loss, because he would have to pay the legal fees if he lost, it wasn't particularly a problem for him because he'd never be able to pay it. So he did lose, and this was over a £3,000 transaction, and the bank put at least £50,000 worth of lawyer time into it, and they never got that money back. And they knew they were never going to get the money back. So it's clear that they didn't want to seem to set any precedent where they would admit any weaknesses. the trial was overall fairly disappointing because I was there to look at the technical evidence and the bank lost it. There was essentially no technical evidence presented as to what happened. But under the UK system, the fact that you lose evidence is not really held against you unless it was clear that you did this maliciously. So the judge judged on the very small amount of information available and then he sided with Halifax. It was essentially the judge was explained that he was in a very awkward position where he had to make a decision, and I think all he had to go on was the character of the people involved. I'm aware of another case, which is Emma Wolfe. She was a card fraud victim, and she was with Abbey, now Santander Bank. And there were a series of fraudulent ATM withdrawals, and she said that she didn't do them. Santander said that it must have been her, because her card and her PIN were used. And the bank actually accused her fiancé of carrying out this fraud. And then this was rolling on for at least 6 months. And then the police showed up at the home of one of the bank employees and found piles of account details. So it was a bank employee who was almost certainly changing the address of the customer, asking for a new card to be sent, and then changing the address back again. So it was a genuine card and PIN, it just wasn't being used by the correct person. And at that point, the bank gave her money back, but on condition that she didn't talk to the press about it.
You mentioned using your exploiting of the loophole with POS terminals. Did you actually try it with ATM?
We haven't tried, but we believe it will not work. Because the way that ATMs work in the UK is the PIN is not sent to the card to be checked, it's sent to the bank which issued you the card to be checked. It's encrypted and then sent over there. So I'm almost certain it wouldn't work in the UK. Maybe other countries, but not here.
And with the situation that you encountered, which you were able to exploit, was that system using the CVR?
It was following the... what do you mean by using CVR?
Well, there's a card verification result as well as a terminal verification result, isn't there?
Yes. Okay, so we were not tampering with the CVR. So for the purposes of other people here, when the card sends back the MAC, it sends back some other details. And one of these is a bit called several bits which incorporate a bit which says, was the PIN verified or not? So what the banks see is they see the CVR which says the PIN was not verified. What they don't see is what the terminal thought, because that is in a field which is optional. So on one hand, the card thinks it was a signature transaction. The terminal thinks it's a PIN transaction. And then the bank sees that it's definitely not a PIN transaction. And the bank could decide to reject all transactions which are not PIN verified. But when we saw the data that was coming back from some of the banks, that would reject a significant number of non-fraudulent transactions. And trying to stop this sort of fraud requires an incredibly accurate detector, because there are a vast number of chip and PIN transactions, and the vast majority of these are not fraudulent. So even if you have a detector, some way of looking for fraudulent transactions that's 99.999% accurate, then you're going to reject essentially only legitimate transactions, and that will annoy customers. Mm-hmm. So the CVR is useful, but it's not sufficient on its own to be a perfect identifier for fraudulent transactions. And that's why it's not a trivial fix to look at the CVR and try to stop that sort of fraud.
I have two questions. One is, have you anything positive to say? And secondly, do you have any cards that you use yourself?
I do use cards, because my bank called me about some suspected fraud. It wasn't fraud. But on the first question, positive things to say. This is helping getting fraud victims get their money back. We're pointing this out, and then sometimes the bank just gives back the money to the customer, and in some cases it's causing the banks to hand over more information, which allows us to establish what's really going on. And I think as an academic, I'm quite interested in finding out what is really going wrong with the system. And this doesn't necessarily mean that the customers get off. They don't always get their money back, but we find out a little bit more about what happened. An example of this is a case of where someone in South Africa lost a bunch of money from his bank account through transactions in London, and the bank, Diners Club, didn't give his money back. And I wasn't involved in this course case, but Ross Anderson was, and he went to the High Court to argue this and was able to show that the bank's evidence was complete nonsense. Then what the bank did was hired a private investigator and found out that on the time that this fraud happened, the fraud victim's brother was on a plane to London, or was just arrived from a plane to London. And what's more, his plane ticket was bought by the same person who bought the plane ticket for a bunch of other people who also had this happen to them. So it looks like some sort of criminal gang were doing fraudulent transactions and in this way, and then saying that it wasn't them. So by showing flaws in the technical system, we're able to get the person charged with the right crime rather than the wrong crime. But we'll know a bit more.
Are there any other problems with this system that we should be aware of? With chip and pin, I mean.
There's none that I have not talked about, but there was 4,000 pages of specification, and every time we look at it, we find something new. So I think, like any complex system, there will be plenty of bugs. In particular, I don't know what's going on with ATM fraud, because the majority of people who come to us saying that they've lost money has been because of an ATM transaction. And some of those can be explained by crooked bank insiders, but probably not all of it. And there are some people who have very credible stories as to why their PIN could not have been compromised. In some cases, they didn't even know their PIN. But I don't have an adequate explanation for that. Maybe it's just bad luck, but maybe there are some security problems there that we haven't found yet.
Suppose EMV Co, who own the Standard, said, come to you and your colleagues and say, okay, clearly this is not right. What would be your priority list of things to do? Where would you start? Another question is this something that the banks themselves could fix in their host systems, their own processing, or is it actually so fundamental to EMV that we'd need to EMV too, say?
So I think my priority to EMV Co would be to dramatically shrink the specification. So it starts off using a few hundred pages, now it's a few thousand. I think it could be written in less than 100, mainly by trimming out the options that are either very rarely used or not used at all, and then slightly expand the scope. So the EMV says how a card can talk to a terminal and there be able to interoperate. It doesn't say anything about security, or almost nothing about security. So I think the specification to say what are the security properties that should be there, how they should be maintained, and then how the system works. And I think that can be probably less than 50 pages, because it is, as it's used in the UK, it's a very simple system, but because of all the other options, it's become hugely complicated. And what was your second question?
Replacing cards is very slow and expensive. Is there anything that could be done by the banks, certainly in the issuing end, to look for in CVR? And is if EMV Co, as the owner of the standard, were to insist that this data were carried in transactions, would that then give the banks the ability to spot the kind of compromises that are going on?
So there's a few things that could be done, but it's not really necessary to replace the cards. It is necessary to replace the software or change the software on the back-end authorization systems. In particular, they should compare the CVR, which is mandatory, well, in Visa and MasterCards it's certainly mandatory, with some other way of working out what the terminal thought was going on, and that's the hard part. Cards could be changed to request the CVMR, cardholder verification method results. Some do, some don't. In the UK, there's a different standard, APAC standard 70, which says that the CVMR should be sent back at least to the bank which has a commercial relationship with the shop, even though that doesn't get back all the way to the issuer. And when we've talked to people about implementing this, it should work on paper and it doesn't work in practice, because sometimes the CVMR generated by the terminal is just wrong. Sometimes it's complete nonsense. It talks about PIN was entered but PIN pad not present. So things that just cannot exist. And that's just bugs. And the bugs haven't been caught because so far issuers have not been relying on the CVMR to make any decisions. And another issue is that CVMR is sometimes lost on the way back to the issuing bank. And I think the specification does allow a secure system to be built. It doesn't forbid it, but it doesn't give you very much help. So I think if the specification gave a bit more help and a bit more testing for these cases, then that would be very useful.
Is part of the problem here also the fact that the where you've got to detect the problem is in the issuer system, where the authorization is, but that you're wholly reliant on data provided by the acquiring system where the chip and the PIN were actually processed? And traditionally, those two applications are totally separate and they're not operated by the same people.
Yes, there was a big commercial problem that happened when chip and PIN was introduced. So as people who are around the UK would have seen, it came in dramatically fast for an industry that's got a reputation of moving slowly. The way that this was done was by liability shifting. So when there was a transaction that was not a chip and PIN transaction, the party which caused it not to be chip and PIN was responsible for any fraud. So if the bank hadn't issued chip cards, they were responsible for fraud. And if the merchant hadn't deployed and upgraded the terminal, they were responsible for the fraud. So that gave a lot of incentive to both sides to roll out the system as fast as possible. This also made the merchants very resentful because the banks were faster than them. And they covered almost all chip card fraud for quite a long time. And by the time they got to the terminals, they were very reluctant about upgrading them. And once this liability shift happened, the bank industry no longer had a stick to beat the merchants with. And so when terminals were buggy, they weren't really able to introduce anything new because the issuers didn't have much of a commercial relationship with with the people who are deploying the chip and PIN terminals. So I think that was one of the reasons for the problems. There could be some changes in the specification which would help that. So we've mentioned about the CVR, and this is reliable. The card really will produce a CVR that says the PIN is not verified if it didn't get the correct PIN. But the problem is that the CVR is not specified in EMV. It's specified in some MasterCard and Visa documentation, and terminals are not allowed to use that field to make a decision. They would need to request the card would need to be changed to request that the terminal send it the CVMR, cardholder verification method results, and then the card would then need to see if the terminal's perspective of things which are going on matches the card's perspective. And I think that would be a change to the EMV specification to allow that to happen. So it's all very complicated and quite messy, and it involves commercial relationships as well as technical decisions.
You mentioned earlier, I think, that some of the European countries don't use this mechanism, but they have a secure mechanism. So what is their mechanism, and why didn't EMV choose to follow that?
Nowadays, pretty much all countries use EMV, but not all in the same way. So when we discovered this flaw, we talked to the UK authorities, Financial Services Authority, the Federal Reserve in the US, and the European Central Bank. And in response, many central banks and countries said that they were not vulnerable to this. In particular, the French banks were very insistent that this did not affect them. And for France, this is a matter of national pride because they developed the smart card system and were very involved in EMV. And it turns out that the French were wrong. We did a test on a French card and it was just as vulnerable as everyone else. Germany were correct. They were not vulnerable. And that's not because they're not using EMV, but because they're using a different way of verifying the PIN. So if you type your PIN into a German point-of-sale terminal, almost certainly your PIN will be encrypted and then sent back to the bank, and the fraudster can't interfere easily in that communication, and that's why they're not vulnerable. That is actually forbidden in the UK, that way of operating. The reason behind that is it would require giving a key, cryptographic key, to every terminal, and then using this for encrypting the PIN, and that would be quite expensive.
Are there any steps that we can take to prevent us falling victim to such fraud, or is it just a matter of time before we get struck?
One thing you can do is not have cards, but that really causes a lot of problems when trying to lead a normal life, so it's not something that I do. Another solution that some people do is to get a chip and signature card. So this is where your card does not have a PIN, and therefore the bank cannot say that your PIN was correctly entered because it doesn't really have one. Banks are very reluctant to give you these, but they're legally required to under Disability Discrimination Act. If you can persuade them that you cannot remember a PIN, and that there are a lot of people who can't, or you can't safely enter it, then they're obliged to give you a chip and signature card. That will not be accepted everywhere, so you might run into problems using it, but it puts you in a better legal position. As for preventing it, there's not too much you can do. What you can do quite a lot is dealing with it when it happens. So a mistake that many people do, very understandable, is that the bank will ask you to cut up your card, and then the customer will then cut up their card. But actually, the card contains evidence which can be used to clear your name. At a very minimum, it will contain the number of transactions that have happened. So if the bank says that there were 10 legitimate transactions and 10 fraudulent ones, and your card says it knows about 12 transactions, then clearly there's another card that is in operation with your account details. So definitely don't cut up your card. Another thing you can do is ask for as much evidence as possible as soon as possible. Because what will frequently happen is the bank will give you your money back initially, and then a few months down the line they'll take it back off you again and say that it's actually your fault. And by that time all the evidence is gone. Whereas if you ask for all the evidence up front, so all the technical details and also things like CCTV, then it means that if the bank then backs down and does take the money off you, then you've actually got something to show them.
I seem to remember that Sainsbury's had a whole batch of card readers that had been tampered with and sent card numbers and perhaps PIN details to an outside agency. If I remember rightly, it was something like the readers were made in the Far East. They were sent to Sainsbury's via a distributor in, I think, India, and there was an employee or a group of employees there who physically tampered with the things and put a little radio transmitter inside it, so that it apparently worked all right, but as well was sending out the spurious radio signal. Is the system still vulnerable to that kind of thing, or has that particular way of criminals addressing it been blocked now?
It's getting a lot better, but it's not fully fixed, because there were two potential fixes to that, one of which is making the terminals impossible to tamper with, and that was not feasible to do. They'd be far, far too expensive and far too unreliable if the terminals were going to be modified in that sense. So then there were two initiatives. One was to reduce the presence of swipe and dock readers. These are readers which read the magstripe and your chip data at the same time. And that means if someone tampers with one of these, then you've got your magstripe, and then they've got your PIN, and then they can commit some fraud with magstripe. So those things were phased out. And then the chip data was changed, so it was no longer possible to construct a valid magstripe based on just the chip data. So if you have one of these cards, and I think they are started to be rolled out in about 2008, then if someone tampers with a chip and PIN terminal, they will get all the chip data, but they won't get the magstripe data, and that shouldn't be enough to commit fraud on itself.
Do you see, just briefly, any issues potentially relating in this matter with regard to the RFID sort of close proximity cards that I know at least one major card producer are sending out?
So I think RFID is the thing that we're going to look into next. It's quite difficult to look into compared to EMV, because for all its flaws, EMV is a public specification. You can go on the web and download it for free. That is not the case for RFID system. A lot of it's public, but the security information is not public. So we're not entirely sure what is going on there. It is very similar to EMV, but it's not the same. And there are some quite important differences. In some ways, it's more secure. So another attack that is possible is something called the yes card attack. This is where you take someone's card and then you clone the chip data onto another card. And then on this other card, you make it accept any PIN. Now, this sounds a lot like no PIN attack, but it's different because it's a fake card rather than talking to the real card. And that card will work in offline transactions because it knows all the public data. It will say yes to any PIN, but as soon as it talks to the real bank, it will be rejected. And that's because UK cards are predominantly called our SDA, static data authentication. There is an enhanced version of EMV called DDA, dynamic data authentication, which is not vulnerable to that type of fraud. And all RFID cards are DDA in the UK. So it's improved in that sense. That sounds good on paper. In actual practice, it doesn't make very much difference, because while SDA cards have this flaw where you can copy them, it only works on offline transactions, and offline essentially never happens in the UK, because phone lines are so cheap, phone calls are so cheap, that you might as well always contact the bank for it to be verified. The only time I've seen offline transactions is buying train tickets.
Do you see a time when it will be cost-effective to use biometrics, either in place of or in addition to PINs?
I think cost is probably not the issue here, but it's making it work reliably enough. This is something. There was an APAX document from 2007 where they said that this is something that they want to look into. There's various different ways of doing it. One is where your card contains the biometric template, say fingerprint. It sends it to the terminal, and then the terminal checks whether it matches. But this has the problem that if the terminal is corrupt, then it's, well, firstly, it's got your fingerprint, which isn't so good, and secondly, it can always say yes. If you do matching on the card, then that improves some things. But how does the card know that the fingerprint it's getting is a real fingerprint and it's not just being fed some data from a fingerprint that was recorded somewhere else? So there's complications in that. Another one is that although banks will not publicly admit it, it is very useful to them that you can tell your PIN to someone else, because very, very many people tell their PIN to other people, so people in their family. And if you suddenly prevent customers from using other people's cards, then that will reduce the number of transactions and it will make some customers very unhappy. So it means that the father can't give the kid the credit card to use in emergencies and things like that. So I think those two issues will have to be dealt with before biometrics will be feasible, even assuming that they'll be cost effective.
I hope I won't be misunderstood here, but what is the easiest kind of approach to defrauding a card?
It's difficult to know, because it really depends on the skill sets of the criminals carrying them out. If there are very different criminal communities that deal with stealing cards versus going online and breaking into card databases and doing things there. So I don't think there are very many people that are in the position where they could choose to do any of these, because muggers typically aren't very good at breaking into encryption systems. Probably the most profitable one is to go after card numbers in very large quantities. And there, I think it would be card-not-present transactions. So you don't intercept someone's computer because then you get one. You break into a merchant, get all their card details, and then use those for fraudulent online purchases. I think there the hardest part is more getting money out of the system rather than actually committing the fraud in the first place. Because you can buy goods online, but how do you actually get money? One way of doing this, I might get to see in the next few weeks because I'm organising a conference and I'm responsible for the credit card payments. And one thing that we get very often is someone will register for a dubious card. So, for example, we've had one registrant who's given a Nigerian postal address, but the billing address for the card he used is an oxygen cylinder supply company in Minnesota. So that's a bit iffy. And then the next step is almost certainly they will say that some terrible disaster has befallen their family. They can't come. Could they please get a refund via Western Union? So that's one way of trying to get the system out of the banking industry and into the cash industry, because cash can't be rolled back. Whereas once you're in, say, at least one country's banking industry, things can be rolled back 3 months later, 3 months after the fact, or certainly they used to be able to do that. So I think getting money out is the hard part.
You mentioned asking the bank for all their information. Is there a public source where one can find out what information one should be seeking from the bank? Because clearly you say, give me all your information, and they give you not enough at their will.
Yeah, so there are two useful resources. So one is the website of Stephen Mason, and the other one is Alistair Kelman. And they're both lawyers, and they both have web pages on the legal situation and the sort of information that you should be asking for. But it's actually very difficult because the banks use very different IT systems, and the information that they store often varies quite a lot. So I don't think there is any general recommendation you can give about what sort of information to ask and then know whether they're giving you everything. I think in this case of Alan Job versus Halifax, basically the only information that came back was one byte. And there was one byte of content there. I think it was 3B, and 3B said 3B meant I was told that this was a chip and pin transaction and everything verified, and all these other things get compressed down. There were more detailed logs in the past, but they'd gone.
So I suppose the next logical question then is, if we were subjected to a fraud, which is the best bank to be with?
Yeah, I'm not sure, because these sort of cases don't get that far very often enough for me to make any sample. So I can't really be confident about anything to do with that. From what we've seen, it matters more about who you are rather than what the bank is. So if you're well-spoken, capable of making good arguments, then you're probably in a very good position. If you have not very much money and you're not good at dealing with authority, then you've got a much lower chance of getting your money back. And I think that's particularly problematic from a public policy perspective, because the people who have the influence of changing policy are almost certainly never going to lose any money. It's the more vulnerable members of society. So I think the majority of people who come to us definitely the majority are women and mainly pensioners. Alan Job was a refugee, so he was not a very good customer to the bank. But if you're a good customer, they won't look at the logs. They'll just give you your money back on the basis that they don't want to lose you as a customer. I would very much like to get statistics on how much banks... first of all, how much loss there is for customers, how many refused requests for refunds there are per bank. But I don't think there's even enough data currently collected for that. The data that is collected is only per bank total fraud losses. And there are interesting things in that. The information is not public. But one thing we did find out is that in 2008, one bank was responsible for about 90% of all fraud. The following year, they hired a better security team and went down to about 10. So there is very significant deviation between the banks. In that, I could imagine there's very different deviation in terms of how much of a chance you have of getting your money back. But I don't know the answer.
For this attack to work, you do have to have your cards physically stolen from you.
Yes. For The Yes Card attack I mentioned, that's a clone card, but that essentially doesn't work because of the situation with no offline transactions in the UK. With this one, the attack will only work if the card is stolen and has not yet been cancelled. So if you notice it's been cancelled, if you notice it's been stolen, you can tell the bank and cancel the card, and this won't work.
Okay, my second question is, you were saying that the card does actually report that the PIN was not entered.
Yes.
So in theory, the bank saying that the PIN was entered is verging on fraudulent.
That case has certainly been made. We have talked to the police about that, but they have no interest in prosecuting the banks. One of the main problems is that the part of the police that is responsible for investigating banking fraud is a dedicated check and plastic card fraud unit, which is 100% paid for by the banks. So that's one of the issues that's going on there. I think the reason these things happen is, I think, not so much maliciousness, but more incompetence. And part of this 4,000 pages of specification is many messages that are being sent back to the bank. And the CVR can be trusted because it is generated by the card and it's authenticated by the card. But there are other flags sent back to the bank which say that the PIN is verified but cannot be relied upon because it says, for example, the terminal's perspective of whether the PIN is verified, which is wrong, versus the card, which can be relied upon. So when the data is being summarised to the fraud investigation, they may well see PIN verified when it was not verified.
Okay. Have you ever managed to get back the whole log of the transaction, including the CVR?
Not from legal requests. Occasionally, it's printed on the receipt, but not very often.
Presumably, there are options for defrauding traders with offline transactions with bogus cards and so on. I mean, the classic thing, of course, in the restaurant is where the terminal is brought to your desk, where there's a two-way possibility of defrauding either side. Are there any technical provisions that you can think of that would actually ameliorate those wide-open positions?
So that's where the customer is trying to defraud the merchant?
Where maybe a customer will try and defraud a merchant by using a bogus card where there is an offline terminal, walking away with the goods, and then the transaction is disallowed. Or where, for example, the classic one in a restaurant, where the device you're handed is actually a skimming device and the waiter's pocketing the change. And they're fairly basic, simple problems. I'm wondering if there's any technical measures that could reinforce us against those.
So the main one that's going on for that is just forbidding offline transactions. So when chip and PIN was introduced, there were 80% were online. Then a few years later, it was 90%. And now I think there are negligible amounts of transaction offline, which means that stolen cards which are reported and clone cards should be detected. There's still going to be software bugs, so maybe you can get by somewhere. As for preventing skimming, you can't prevent the magstripe being read. What you can do is prevent that data being useful. And what the card industry is trying to do is push for everyone in the world to use chip-based cards and then eventually eliminate magstripes. The big gap there is the US, because the US banks have no interest in deploying chip cards. One reason is because it would reduce the amount of interchange fees they get because of the way things have been set up. So, I mean, they would earn less per transaction. Another reason is they would not be able to do the liability shift that's happened in the UK. Because in the US, firstly, the court system is different. One is that if you sue a bank and you lose, you pay your legal fees, you don't pay their legal fees. So it's much easier to sue a bank. There's some very clear law and plenty of precedent which says that if there is a fraudulent transaction, then it is the bank's problem above $50. And another one is the potential for class actions. So many customers can get together and make one law case against a bank. In the UK, that's not permitted. You can't do class actions in general.
There's a major discrepancy in liability between credit card and debit card transactions. Can you give us any information on the background to this?
So when credit cards were introduced, they fell under the Consumer Credit Act, which actually gave much better protection for fraud. That, in practice, wasn't as good as it sounded, because the law is only relevant when you take something to court, and it's very hard and very risky to take these cases to court. But things are starting to change. So I think last year there was the Payment Services Act introduced, which was implementation of the European Union Payment Services Regulations. And that covered both credit and debit cards. And that said that if there was fraud, then the bank had to prove their systems were operating correctly. And that's good, but it's very hard to actually enforce because you can't easily sue a bank. And the institution that is responsible for dealing with disputed transactions before going to court is a financial services ombudsman, and they don't seem very interested in the technical, looking at the technical evidence. So, for example, in the cases that I've helped with and have tried to give more information to the customer, when I send to the financial services ombudsman saying that you need to look at this data because the conclusion you reached in this section was incorrect, the response has always been we rely on the information that's given to us by the banks. So it's difficult to deal with that sort of thing.
There are no more questions, then on behalf of the branch, may I thank you very much indeed, Stephen, for your presentation, which has clearly kept people enthralled. And we may be more cautious what we do with our cards. And just forget about leaving mine in the wallet. And may I present you on behalf of the branch as the token of our esteem.
Yeah, thanks very much.